status quo. When we challenge our equilibrium, discomfort serves as an early warning system, alerting us that we are entering uncharted territory and urging us to return to safe ground. In the case of real danger, the experience of alarm is useful and self-protective. Subject a muscle to excessive demand, for example, and you risk significant injury. But expose the muscle to ordinary demand and it won't grow. Expanding capacity requires a willingness to endure short-term discomfort in the service of long-term reward. The same paradoxical phenomenon applies to achieving long-term satisfaction and well-being. We can experience pleasure without any investment of psychic energy, whereas enjoyment happens only as a result of unusual investments of attention, writes psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, author of Flow. The best moments in our lives usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. Most of us have experienced this phenomenon. The intensity of pleasure that we derive from a given activity tends to diminish over time. Much as we fear change, the deepest satisfaction comes from our willingness to expose ourselves to new challenges and engage in novel experiences. The willingness to challenge our comfort zones depends partly on our degree of underlying security. To whatever degree we are consumed by anxious concerns and attempts to fill deficits for energy or material security or self-esteem, we are less willing to expose ourselves to any discomfort. When there isn't much fuel in our tanks and our inner experiences that we feel threatened, we tend to hoard the energy we have and use our limited stores in the service of self-protection. We refer to this phenomenon as defense spending. Accurately assessing the level of threat in our lives is critical if we are to continue to grow rather than forever defending what we have. Throughout our lives, we face storms of varying levels of intensity in all dimensions, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. When the force of the storm is greater than we can handle physically, the result might be a broken bone or a heart attack. The first imperative is to protect the injured limb or organ from further stress. A physician puts a broken arm in a cast to protect the bone as it heals, or prescribes bed rest immediately following a heart attack. But we can't leave the cast on or remain sedentary for too long. Inactivity very quickly causes atrophy and loss of strength. Rehabilitation is the process by which we systematically build back capacity. The approach is always the same: gradual and incremental exposure to increasing doses of stress. Push too hard or too quickly, and you're likely to get hurt again. This is true of a broken arm or a damaged heart, but it applies equally to other dimensions in which sudden storms have sapped our strength. If you are a victim of a violent crime, or lose a loved one, or get fired from a job, the first need is for healing, recovery, and time to regroup. Rebuilding energy capacity requires gradually re-exposing ourselves to the demands of the world that dealt us the setback in the first place. So long as sufficient healing has occurred, it is often possible to build capacity past our previous limits. The same principle applies to building capacity by conscious choice. Think about an infant venturing away from his mother, but turning back frequently to make sure that she is still there. The infant is testing his current comfort zone. His mother's smile of reassurance is a source of emotional recovery and positive renewal. It makes him feel empowered to take a few steps further into the unknown, to continue expanding his capacity. Without that reassurance, he comes scurrying back to his mother. We are not so different as adults. When we feel threatened, we tend to retreat. Recovery is a means of detoxifying and refueling so that we can return to the storm with renewed energy. When we feel challenged rather than threatened, we are more willing to extend ourselves, even if it means taking some risk and experiencing some discomfort along the way. When we first suggested to Roger B. that he lacked sufficient capacity in part because he hadn't exposed himself to sufficient stress, he was incredulous. "My life is more stressful than ever," he insisted. "I'm getting less help from my boss. I've got more people to supervise, fewer resources, and more competition. If what you're saying is right, how come I'm not getting stronger? Many of our clients initially raise the same question. The answer, we tell them, is that the key to expanding capacity is both to push beyond one's ordinary limits and to regularly seek recovery, which is when growth actually occurs. There was no area of Roger's life in which he was doing both. At the physical and spiritual level, he wasn't spending enough energy to build capacity. Because he was undertraining those muscles, they continued to atrophy. In the other two dimensions, mental and emotional, Roger was overtraining, subjecting himself to excessive stress without sufficient intermittent recovery. The result was that he felt overwhelmed. His solution was simply to keep pushing. What he needed was time to detoxify and to change channels in order to periodically renew mentally and emotionally. Roger was pushing himself too hard in some dimensions and not hard enough in others. The ultimate consequence was the same: diminished capacity in the face of rising demand. The importance of physical energy seems obvious for athletes, construction workers, and farmers, because the rest of us are evaluated more by what we do with our minds than with our bodies. We tend to discount the role that physical energy plays in performance. In most jobs, the physical body has been completely cut off from the performance equation. In reality, physical energy is the fundamental source of fuel, even if our work is almost completely sedentary. It not only lies at the heart of alertness and vitality, but also affects our ability to manage our emotions, sustain concentration, think creatively, and even maintain our commitment to whatever mission we are on. Leaders and managers make a fundamental mistake when they assume that they can overlook the physical dimension of energy and still expect those who work for them to perform at their best. At the time we met Roger B., he had never thought much about managing his energy in any part of his life, and he gave virtually no attention to the physical dimension. He realized that he would probably feel better if he got more sleep and exercised regularly, but the way he saw it, he simply didn't have the time. He knew that his diet wasn't very healthy, but he couldn't summon much motivation to change. Instead, he tried not to think about the consequences of his choices. Mostly what Roger felt was busy and numb. At the most basic level, physical energy is derived from the interaction between oxygen and glucose. In practical terms, the size of our energy reservoir depends on the patterns of our breathing, the foods that we eat and when we eat them, the quantity and quality of our sleep, the degree to which we get intermittent recovery during the day, and the level of our fitness. Building a rhythmic balance between physical energy expenditure and recovery ensures that the level of our energy reserves remains relatively constant. Pushing past our comfort zone and then recovering is a means by which to expand physical capacity wherever it is insufficient to meet demand. The most important rhythms in our lives are the ones we typically take for granted, most notably breathing and eating. Few of us even think about breathing. Oxygen becomes precious only in those rare instances when we can't get enough, choking on a piece of food, getting caught in an ocean undertow, or suffering from a disease such as emphysema. Even significant changes in our pattern of breathing tend to go unnoticed. Anxiety and anger, for example, typically prompt faster and shallower breathing, which can be valuable in responding to an immediate threat. Very quickly, however, such a breathing pattern reduces our available energy and compromises our ability to restore mental and emotional equilibrium. The result can be a cycle that reinforces itself, which explains why one of the simplest antidotes to anger and anxiety is to take deep abdominal breaths. The breath is a powerful tool for self-regulation, a means both to summon energy and to relax deeply. Extending the exhalation, for example, prompts a powerful wave of recovery. Breathing in to a count of three and out to a count of six lowers arousal and quiets not just the body, but also the mind and the emotions. Deep, smooth, and rhythmic breathing is simultaneously a source of energy, alertness, and focus, as well as of relaxation, stillness, and quiet, the ultimate healthy pulse. The second critical source of physical energy in our lives comes from the foods we eat. The costs of not eating enough, renewing energy with food that gets converted into glycogen, are clear. Most of us have not had much experience with prolonged hunger, but we all know the visceral feeling of being hungry and its impact on our ability to function effectively at all levels. On an empty stomach, it is difficult to be concerned with much besides food. Chronic overeating, on the other hand, represents too much recovery, leads to obesity, compromised energy, and has both performance and health consequences. Foods high in fats, sugar, and simple carbohydrates provide recovery, but in a much less efficient and energy-rich form than low-fat proteins and complex carbohydrates such as vegetables and grains. Eating better obviously has benefits in and of itself, including losing weight, looking better, and improving health, all of which may have positive energy consequences. Our primary aim is to help clients sustain a steady, high-octane source of energy throughout the day. When you awake in the morning, after 8 to 12 hours without eating, your blood glucose levels are at a low ebb, even if you don't feel consciously hungry. Eating breakfast is critically important. It not only increases blood glucose levels, but also jump-starts metabolism. It is equally important to eat foods that are low on the glycemic index, which measures the speed with which sugar from specific foods is released into the bloodstream. A slower release provides a steadier source of energy. The low glycemic breakfast foods that provide the highest octane and longest lasting source of energy include whole grains, proteins, and low glycemic fruits such as strawberries, pears, grapefruit, and apples. By contrast, high glycemic foods such as muffins or sugary cereals spike energy for short periods but prompt a crash in as few as 30 minutes. Even a breakfast traditionally viewed as healthy, an unbuttered bagel and a glass of orange juice, is very high on the glycemic index and therefore a poor source of sustaining energy. The frequency with which we eat also influences our capacity to stay fully engaged and to sustain high performance. Eating 5 to 6 low-calorie, highly nutritious meals a day ensures a steady resupply of energy. Even the most energy-rich foods won't fuel high performance for the 4 to 8 hours that many of us frequently permit to pass between meals. In one study at New York's Mount Sinai Hospital, subjects were placed in an environment with no clocks or time cues. Provided with food, they were told to eat whenever they were hungry. They did so an average of once every 96 minutes. Sustained performance depends not just on eating at regular intervals, but also on eating only as much as you need to drive your energy for the next 2 to 3 hours. Portion control is critical, both in managing weight and in regulating energy. It is just as problematic to eat too much, too often, as it is to eat too little, too infrequently. Snacks between meals should typically be between 100 and 150 calories, and once again should focus on low glycemic foods such as nuts and sunflower seeds, fruits, or half a typical size 200 calorie energy bar. To maximize physical energy capacity, we must become more attuned to what satisfaction actually feels like, neither hungry nor stuffed. Most of us spend far too much time at one end of the scale or the other, often swinging wildly between the two extremes. We allow too much time to elapse between meals and then compensate by eating too much at once. Because our energy requirements tend to diminish as evening approaches and our metabolism slows, it makes sense to eat more calories earlier in the day and fewer in the evening. In one study of children ages 7 to 12, for example, subjects were classified into 5 weight categories from thin to obese. On average, they all consumed about the same number of calories per day. The one variable, it turned out, was that children in the 2 heaviest categories ate less at breakfast and more at dinner than their leaner counterparts. Other than eating and breathing, sleeping is the most important source of recovery in our lives. It is also the most powerful of the circadian rhythms that include body temperature, hormone levels, and heart rates. the vast majority of our clients report that they are significantly sleep-deprived. Few of them recognize just how dramatically insufficient sleep affects their performance and their level of engagement both at home and at work. Even small amounts of sleep debt, insufficient recovery in our terms, have a significant impact on strength, cardiovascular capacity, mood, and overall energy levels. Some 50 studies have shown that mental performance, reaction time, concentration, memory, and logical analytical reasoning all decline steadily as sleep debt increases. Sleep needs vary by age, gender, and genetic predisposition. But the broad scientific consensus is that the average human being needs 7 to 8 hours a night to function optimally. Several studies have shown that when human beings are placed in isolation with no exposure to natural light or to clocks, they still sleep approximately 7 to 8 hours out of every 24. In one especially dramatic study, psychologist Dan Kripke and his colleagues studied the sleep patterns of 1 million people over 6 years. Mortality rates from nearly all causes of death were lowest among people who slept between 7 and 8 hours a night. For those sleeping less than 4 hours, mortality rates were 2.5 times higher. For those sleeping more than 10 hours, the rates were 1.5 times higher. In short, both too little recovery and too much recovery appear to significantly increase the risk of mortality. The specific times that we sleep also affect our energy levels, health, and performance. Numerous studies have shown that shift workers, meaning those who work at night, have twice the number of highway accidents as day workers and considerably more on-the-job accidents as well. Shift workers also suffer a far higher incidence of coronary artery disease and heart attacks than do day workers. On a broader scale, every one of the great industrial disasters of the past 20 years, Chernobyl, the Exxon Valdez, Bhopal, Three Mile Island, occurred in the middle of the night. For the most part, those in charge had worked very long hours and built up considerable sleep debt. The disastrous crash of the Challenger space shuttle in 1986, in which 7 astronauts lost their lives, occurred after NASA officials made an ill-fated judgment to go ahead with the launch, having already worked for more than 20 consecutive hours. In addition to its energy-renewing function, sleep is also a period during which substantial growth and repair occurs, most of it at the deepest level of sleep, when slow-wave delta brainwaves are dominant. During those periods, cell division is most active, the greatest number of growth hormones and repair enzymes are released, and muscles that have been stressed during the day have an opportunity to regenerate. In short, we heal and grow most during the deepest periods of recovery. There may be no more extreme example of deliberately overriding the human need for intermittent recovery than the long-standing system of training medical students to become physicians. They work in shifts as long as 36 consecutive hours for as many as 120 hours in a week. In 1984, the journalist Sidney Zion brought a widely publicized lawsuit after his daughter Libby died following a visit to the emergency room of a New York City hospital. A grand jury ultimately concluded that she had received woefully inadequate care from inexperienced interns and residents operating on little or no sleep. You need not be a medical resident or work exceptionally long hours for fatigue and insufficient recovery to influence your level of engagement and performance. Just as we cycle through levels of sleep at night, so our potential for engagement varies during our waking hours. The shifts of energy that we experience are tied to the ultradian rhythms that regulate physiological markers of alertness at 90 to 120-minute intervals. Ultimately, many of us override these naturally occurring rhythms to the point that they no longer even penetrate conscious awareness. The demands of our everyday lives are so intense and so consuming that they distract our attention from the subtler internal signals telling us that we need recovery. In the absence of any artificial interventions, our energy stores naturally ebb and flow at different times of the day. Somewhere around 3 or 4 p.m., we reach the lowest phase of both our ultradian and our circadian rhythms. The Japanese sleep researchers Yoichi Tsuji and Toshinori Kobayashi have termed this the breaking point, the period of the day when most of us feel the highest level of fatigue. The documented vulnerability to accidents is far higher in the mid-afternoon than at any other daytime period. This explains why, over the centuries, so many cultures intuitively institutionalized the sort of mid-afternoon nap that is increasingly disappearing in our 24/7 world. Given the number of benefits that we derive even from moderate exercise, it seems extraordinary that the vast majority of Americans do almost none. The explanation is surprisingly simple. Building strength and endurance requires pushing past our comfort zones and experiencing discomfort. It takes time before the obvious benefits kick in, and most of us quit before that ever happens. Both strength and cardiovascular training have a powerful impact on health, both energy levels and on performance. Ever since the publication of Kenneth Cooper's book, Aerobics, in the mid-1960s, conventional wisdom has held that the best way to build fitness is through sustained aerobic or steady-state training. Our own experience is that interval training is preferable to continuous exercise and stress. Interval training first emerged as a method for increasing both the speed and endurance of runners in Europe in the 1930s. It involves short to moderate periods of exertion, alternated with short to moderate periods of rest or reduced effort. The underlying premise is that a greater amount of intense work can be accomplished if it is interspersed with periods of rest. The typical recommended exercise protocol is 20 to 30 minutes of continuous exercise, 3 to 5 times a week at 60 to 85% of maximum heart rate. More recently, however, in a joint study conducted by Harvard and Columbia University, researchers found that a series of short doses of intense aerobic activity, each one 60 seconds or less, followed by complete aerobic recovery, had a profound positive impact on participants. In a period of just 8 weeks, the subjects exhibited significant improvement in cardiovascular fitness, heart rate variability, and mood. They also evidenced stronger immune systems and had lower diastolic blood pressure. We believe in the value of interval training, not just for its physical benefits, but also for its practical applicability in navigating the challenges that we face in everyday life. Interval training has long been at the heart of our training process. It can take many forms: sprinting, walking up and down stairs, bicycling, and even weightlifting, so long as the effect is to rhythmically raise and lower heart rate. Both energy expenditure and energy recovery are active physiological processes. In our experience, any form of linear energy expenditure, physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual, is suboptimal for performance and potentially destructive over time. Full engagement requires the capacity to respond quickly and flexibly to whatever demands we face in our lives, but also to shut down and restore equilibrium quickly and efficiently.
Physical energy is the raw fuel for igniting our emotional skills and talents. In order to perform at our best, we must access pleasant and positive emotions, enjoyment, challenge, adventure, and opportunity. Emotions that arise out of threat or deficit, fear, frustration, anger, sadness, have a decidedly toxic feel to them and are associated with the release of specific stress hormones, most notably cortisol. From our perspective, emotional intelligence is simply the capacity to manage emotions skillfully in the service of high positive energy and full engagement. In practical terms, the key muscles or competencies that fuel positive emotion are self-confidence, self-control, social skills, and empathy. Smaller, supportive muscles include patience, openness, trust, and enjoyment. Access to the emotional muscles that best serve performance depends on creating a balance between exercising them regularly and intermittently seeking recovery. Much the way that we deplete cardiovascular capacity or exhaust a bicep by exposing it to stress, so we run down emotionally if we are constantly spending emotional energy without recovery. When our emotional muscles are weak or insufficient to meet demand, if we have a lack of confidence or too little patience, for example, we must systematically build capacity by devising rituals to push past our current capacity and then recover. Physical and emotional energy capacity are inextricably connected. When demand begins to deplete our physical energy reserves, one of the consequences is that we start to feel a sense of emergency. We move into the high negative energy quadrant, which alerts us that some need isn't being met. This was precisely what had happened in Roger B.'s life. Because he paid so little attention to renewing physical energy, the quantity of fuel in his tank had diminished over time. At the same time, he perceived that the pressures and demands in his life were increasing inexorably. Feeling neglected by his boss, worried about his job, and disconnected from his family, Roger became increasingly dominated by the experience of anxiety, frustration, and defensiveness. From an energy perspective, negative emotions are costly and inefficient. Much like a gas-guzzling car, they draw down our energy stores at a rapid rate. For leaders and managers, negative emotions are doubly insidious because they are so infectious. If we're prompting fear, anger, and defensiveness in others, we progressively undermine their ability to perform effectively. Chronic negative emotions, most especially anger and depression, have also been correlated with a broad range of disorders and diseases, ranging from back pain and headaches to heart disease and cancer. Epidemiologist David Snowden made precisely this correlation in his study of 678 aging nuns in the School Sisters of Notre Dame congregation. Snowden set out to study the factors that differentiate nuns who eventually got Alzheimer's disease from those who did not. All of the nuns he studied had been required to write a personal essay when they came into the order in their early 20s. Upon analysis, Snowden discovered that those nuns whose writing expressed a preponderance of positive emotions, happiness, love, hope, gratitude, contentment, tended to live longer and more productive lives. Nuns with the highest number of positive emotion sentences had half the risk of death at any age as those with the lowest numbers of such sentences. This is consistent with the findings from several other studies suggesting that a history of depression, the most insidious of all negative emotions, increases by twofold the likelihood of eventually developing Alzheimer's. These findings deeply influenced Snowden, not just professionally, but also personally. "I now make a conscious effort to regain my physiological balance quickly after an upset," he explains. "I try not to stay stuck in negativity. My goal is to return my body to its normal, healthier state as soon as possible." If positive emotion more efficiently fuels individual high performance, it also has a profound organizational impact. After interviewing a large sample of managers and their employees, the Gallup organization found that no single factor more clearly predicts the productivity of an employee than his relationship with his direct superior. More specifically, Gallup found that the key drivers of productivity for employees include whether they feel cared for by a supervisor or someone at work, whether they have received recognition or praise during the past 7 days, and whether someone at work regularly encourages their development. Put another way, the ability to communicate consistently positive energy lies at the heart of effective management. For many years, Roger B. himself was motivated at work in significant part by the feeling that his boss cared for and believed in him. With a supportive wind at his back, he grew more confident of his own value, more positive in his approach to others, and ultimately more successful as a salesman. Success tends to feed on itself, reinforcing the positive emotions that fuel performance in the first place. But the reverse is also true. When his boss became less available and less visibly supportive, Roger's enjoyment and sense of security at work diminished, and so too did his confidence, his level of engagement, and ultimately his performance. As his own emotional energy turned more negative, Roger began to have the same demoralizing impact on his direct reports that his boss's lack of attention had on him. Stop for a moment and think about someone who has been a mentor in your life. Was his or her energy positive or negative? Have you been more motivated and inspired in your life when you were encouraged, supported, and challenged, or when you were criticized, judged, and threatened? Simply changing channels is an effective method to refuel emotionally. During the past decade, we've been surprised and dismayed to discover how infrequently most people undertake activities simply because they're enjoyable and emotionally nourishing. One of the most revealing questions that we ask the clients who come through our training is how frequently in their lives they experience a sense of joy or deep satisfaction. The most common answer we get is rarely. Think for a moment again about your own life. How many hours a week do you devote to activities purely for the pleasure and renewal they provide? What percentage of the time would you describe yourself as feeling deeply relaxed? When was the last time you truly let go and felt fully disconnected? Any activity that is enjoyable, fulfilling, and affirming tends to prompt positive emotions. Depending on your interests, that may mean singing, gardening, dancing, making love, doing yoga, reading an absorbing book, playing a sport, visiting a museum, attending a concert, or simply spending quiet, reflective time alone after an intense day of engaging with other people. The key, we found, is making such activities priorities and treating the time that you invest in them as sacrosanct. The point is not just that pleasure is its own reward, but more practically, that it is a critical ingredient in sustained performance. Erica R. was a highly successful lawyer at a large corporate firm. Her complaint was that she felt relentlessly pressured by the demands of her job, forever worried about the quality of her work, and guilty about giving too little time to her two sons, ages 11 and 13. Life struck her as an unending series of obligations, and she took every one of them seriously. To control her anxiety, Erica planned her time meticulously and held herself to exacting standards. She had a reputation for being very good at what she did, but also for being rigid and brusque with people. Her relationship with her partners was respectful but distant, and many of the firm's associates tried to avoid being assigned to cases with her. The issue for Erica was less about increasing capacity than it was about relaxing and letting go. Like many of our clients, especially women, she took almost no time for herself. When we asked her to recall a time of great joy in her life, she thought first about the birth of her two children. The only other memories that came immediately to mind were the night of her high school prom and the day of her marriage. Not one of these events had occurred less than a decade ago. Just thinking about taking time for pleasure and relaxation, Erica sheepishly acknowledged, made her feel uncomfortable. Even on vacations with her family, she played the role of chief tour guide, determined to see as many sights as possible and unable to contemplate lying on a beach and simply relaxing. We suggested to Erica that she could be more effective at work, personally and interpersonally, if she created more space between obligations and took specific time out to simply enjoy herself and to refuel emotionally. She already had in place a very regular early morning exercise regimen, but it was scarcely a source of pleasure. She went to the gym 4 days a week before work and pushed herself relentlessly for 30 to 40 minutes on the step machine or the treadmill. She found exercise monotonous, and she hated having to wake up so early in order to get back home before her children awoke. It was just one more obligation to get through. We asked Erica if there was any form of physical activity that she genuinely enjoyed. As a child, she said, she had been a dancer. And while she'd finally burned out on the rigorous demands of ballet, she had always loved other forms of dance, such as modern, jazz, and African. We suggested that she substitute dance classes for her workouts at least a couple of days a week, and consider taking them at the end of the day before returning home as a way to make the transition. Erica agreed to give it a shot. In a short time, dance classes became simultaneously a source of pleasure, a means to fully disconnect from work, and something to which she found herself eagerly looking forward. As we explored further, Erica told us that a second great love in her youth had been reading fiction. As an adult, however, she rarely read for pleasure at all. Spending time in nature was the other activity that she had experienced as deeply renewing, but rarely found time now to do. Erica decided to devise a ritual that combined both sources of enjoyment. Even though she lived in a warm climate, she had for years eaten lunch at her desk in order to save time. She decided to create a 45-minute routine around taking a bag lunch to an arboretum 5 minutes from her office and eating on a bench while reading a novel. In addition, on Saturday morning, she set aside 2 hours for gardening. At first, Erica told us, these new routines seemed almost intolerably indulgent, akin to cutting a class at school. But the blend of dance classes, gardening, and her time in the park made her feel so much better in such a short time that all three activities began to exert a strong pull on her. The impact cascaded into her professional life. Rather than feeling resentful about her workload, as she had for several years, she found that she was able to rediscover a good deal of satisfaction in the intellectual challenge it provided. She remained a demanding taskmaster, but she began to see that she could also serve as a mentor to associates. She also saw that when she was more encouraging, she was often more effective. In the evenings, most especially after dance class, she began to be able to relax more with her husband and children. On the days that Erica didn't dance or take her lunch in the park, she could feel a palpable difference both in her anxiety level and in her ability to focus in the afternoons. Creating a rhythmic balance between energy expenditure and energy recovery is more complex emotionally than it is physically, but no less critical to optimal performance and full engagement. The delicate dance of a healthy friendship, for example, can be a powerful source both of positive energy and of renewal. Gallup found that one of the key factors in sustained performance is having at least one good friend at work. The pulse of a strong relationship involves a rhythmic movement between giving and taking, talking and listening, valuing the other person and feeling commensurately valued in return. A relationship in which you do most of the giving and receive very little in return ultimately prompts a sense of deficit and emptiness. A self-absorbed relationship isn't really much of a relationship at all. When Barbara P. came to see us, she was a single 37-year-old marketing executive who worked exceptionally long hours at her job, in part because she had few friends or outside interests. She ended most days feeling exhausted, resentful, and even despairing. After going through our program and confronting her performance barriers, Barbara recognized that one key to feeling better was to systematically build more recovery into her life. She began by taking an aerobics class at a nearby health club after work each day. As we've noted, a challenging physical workout often serves as a source of positive emotional renewal. And sure enough, Barbara invariably finished her workouts feeling more positive. As she became more physically fit, she felt better about herself and better equipped to handle demands and deal with setbacks at work. To her surprise, however, the most powerful source of positive renewal for Barbara came from the relationships that she made along the way. The aerobics class provided a way to connect with others, and she began to go out regularly for dinner with several of her classmates. Where she had long felt isolated and unappreciated at work, Barbara found that she was able to relax, laugh, and talk freely with her new friends. She became as invested in their lives as they did in hers. Nourished and renewed by the time with these new friends, she built a reservoir of positive emotional energy that she could draw from at her job. Because she was in a more upbeat mood when she arrived at work in the mornings, she found that she was often able to concentrate better. She also became less reactive and more relaxed in her dealings with colleagues and her boss, and her professional relationships improved. When she worked too long without breaks, she could still lose her temper or turn negative, which set her back. But on balance, her more positive feelings fed on one another. Barbara found herself spending so much less energy on anger, resentment, and frustration that she was more able to engage positively at work. There are times when demand overwhelms our emotional capacity, even if we are regularly seeking renewal. Just as there is only so much weight you can lift without running up against your limits, so there is only so much emotional demand you can tolerate without turning negative. The best way to build an emotional muscle, much like a physical muscle, is to push past your current comfort zone and then recover. Perhaps no obstacle to full engagement and high performance is so pervasive and so vexing as insecurity and low self-esteem. Complex and subtle factors account for those feelings, but positive energy rituals can nonetheless be effective in building greater self-confidence. Judith F. had a reasonably successful design business, but lived in constant fear that she would one day be revealed as the imposter she felt herself to be. Anyone who really knew her couldn't possibly like her, she believed. As a result, she was reluctant to actively reach out for new clients and instead relied exclusively on word-of-mouth referrals. She was also reluctant to say what she really felt with clients who had strong opinions of their own for fear of antagonizing them. The cost was that she often felt inauthentic, and she sometimes failed to give clients the benefit of her very well-developed and sophisticated design sense. We began by helping Judith to shift her equation from worrying about how others viewed her to focusing on living each day guided by her own deepest values. The two values that she identified as most fundamental were genuineness and courage, neither of which she felt she exemplified in her everyday life. For years, she would meet people in her community or through her work and see an opportunity to pursue them as potential clients. Fearful of rejection, she wouldn't follow up. One of the first rituals Judith created was to set a quota of calls that she would make to reach out to people, designating Monday and Wednesday mornings at 9 a.m. to pursue new professional leads. In a paradigm shift, Judith increasingly began to measure herself by the courage she demonstrated in making these weekly calls, and not by the particular response she received. She also committed to telling every client who hired her what she really thought about any significant design issue that came up, even if it meant disagreeing with them. Simultaneously, Judith made a decision to be more genuine with people in her personal life rather than trying to figure out how to please them as she had done in the past. To her surprise and relief, the responses she got, both personally and professionally, were far more positive than she anticipated. Most of her clients especially appreciated her clarity and definitiveness. Her old insecurities didn't simply disappear. When she encountered an especially difficult client, she found herself reverting to her old inclination to defer and simply go along in order not to rock the boat. Over time, however, Judith found that she became less concerned with how people viewed her and began deriving a sense of accomplishment and strength instead from acting consistent with the values she held most dear. She discovered that it was possible to be tactful without being inauthentic. The second ritual Judith instituted was to devote some of her time to a cause that she cared about. Giving to others, she decided, was an investment of her time and energy that she very much wanted to make. The activity she chose gave her the opportunity to draw on a strength she had not tapped for many years. Judith had a gift for languages, and she spoke French and Spanish fluently. It turned out that a public high school in the town adjacent to hers had a large population of Spanish-speaking students with a great need for remedial help in learning English. Judith volunteered her time one afternoon a week and got some very precious benefits in return. The opportunity to feel both competent and useful, and a sense of genuine appreciation from the school administrators and from many of the kids as well. While her purpose in volunteering was not to improve her performance at work, the positive ways that it made her feel about herself spilled over into the rest of her life. This was true not just when it came to seeking new clients, but also in the confidence she brought to her design work itself. The deepest expression of emotional capacity is the ability to experience a full range of feelings. Because it is so difficult for the mind to hold contradictory impulses, our tendency is to choose up sides, valuing certain emotional skills while neglecting and even disparaging others. We may overvalue toughness and undervalue tenderness, for example, or do just the reverse, when in fact both represent important emotional muscles in our lives. The same is true of many other opposites: self-control and spontaneity, honesty and compassion, generosity and thriftiness, openness and discretion, passion and detachment, patience and urgency, caution and boldness, confidence and humility. Take a moment to consider how broad a range of emotional muscles you have in your own life. In all likelihood, you will discover that you have considerably more strength on one side of the spectrum than on the other. Notice, too, the judgment that you bring to the relative merits of opposing qualities. No emotional capacity better serves depth and richness more than the willingness to value feelings that seem contradictory and not to choose up sides between them. To be fully engaged emotionally requires celebrating what the Stoic philosophers called anacoluthia, the mutual entailment of the virtues. By this notion, no virtue is a virtue by itself. Rather, all virtues are entailed. Honesty without compassion, for example, becomes cruelty. We are, in effect, the sum of our complexities and contradictions. Practically, we must focus on building emotional capacity wherever it is that we are most out of balance. the ultimate goal is to move more freely and flexibly between our own opposites.
Just as physical energy is the fundamental fuel for emotional competencies, so it is the fuel for mental skills. Nothing so interferes with performance and engagement as the inability to concentrate on the task at hand. To perform at our best, we must be able to sustain concentration and to move flexibly between broad and narrow, as well as internal and external focus. We also need access to realistic optimism, a paradoxical notion that implies seeing the world as it is, but always working positively toward a desired outcome or solution. Anything that prompts appropriate focus and realistic optimism serves performance. The key supportive muscles that fuel optimal mental energy include mental preparation, visualization, positive self-talk, effective time management, and creativity. When it comes to the everyday challenge of performance, the energy of negative thinking is almost invariably undermining and counterproductive. Realistic optimism better serves most of the challenges we face. Perhaps nowhere do we so undervalue the importance of intermittent recovery as in the mental dimensions of our lives. In most work environments, the message, both explicit and implicit, is that working longer and more continuously is the best route to high productivity. We aren't rewarded for taking regular breaks or for building a workout into the middle of a day, or for any pattern of work other than keeping our heads down and grinding away for as long as we can. The problem is that thinking uses up a great deal of energy. The brain represents just 2% of the body's weight, but requires almost 25% of its oxygen. The consequences of insufficient mental recovery range from increased mistakes of judgment and execution to lower creativity and a failure to take reasonable account of risks. The key to mental recovery is to give the conscious, thinking mind intermittent rest. In his provocative book, How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, author Michael Gelb poses a wonderfully revealing question. Where are you when you get your best ideas? Gelb has asked this question to thousands of people over the years, and the most common answers he gets include in the shower, resting in bed, walking in nature, and listening to music. We ask our own clients a similar question, and their answers have ranged from taking a jog, to meditating, to dreaming, to sitting on the beach. Almost no one, Gelb writes, claims to get their best ideas at work. Prolific and productive as Leonardo da Vinci was, Gelb points out, the artist took regular breaks from his work. Rather than sleeping extended hours at night, he relied on numerous cat naps during the day. While da Vinci was working on The Last Supper, he sometimes spent several hours in the middle of the day appearing to be lost in daydreams, in spite of entreaties from his employer, the prior of Santa Maria del Grazie, to work more steadily. The greatest geniuses, da Vinci told his patron, sometimes accomplish more when they work less. In his treatise on painting, da Vinci wrote, "It is a very good plan every now and then to go away and have a little relaxation. When you come back to the work, your judgment will be surer, since to remain constantly at work will cause you to lose the power of judgment." Increasing evidence confirms that the brain itself operates like a muscle, atrophying from disuse and increasing in capacity with active use, even late in life. At Baylor College of Medicine, a research team spent 4 years studying nearly 100 physically healthy people over the age of 64. One-third of them still had jobs. One-third had retired but remained active physically and mentally. The final third had retired and were essentially inactive. After 4 years, the third group scored significantly lower than the first two, not just on IQ tests, but also on those measuring blood flow to their brains. As neurologist Richard Restuck puts it, no matter how old you may be at this moment, it's never too late to change your brain for the better. That's because the brain is different from every other organ in your body. While the liver and the lungs and the kidneys wear out after a certain number of years, the brain gets sharper the more it's used. Indeed, it improves with use. much as it is true physically and emotionally. The balance of stress and recovery appears to be a critical factor in maximizing cognitive capacity. Exposing oneself to short-term stress, for example, can stimulate a burst of adrenaline that actually improves memory. When the demand is more linear and chronic, and stress hormones continue to circulate in the brain, the hippocampus can actually shrink. Much like the body, the brain needs time to recover from exertion. After we have learned new information or had new experiences, it takes time for the brain to consolidate and encode what it has learned. In the absence of downtime or recovery, this learning cannot take place as efficiently. Loss of memory is the most common complaint that people over the age of 40 bring to neurologists. Far more often than not, the explanation is not disease, but rather the failure to actively keep the mind engaged and the resulting atrophy of the muscles of memory. Much as is the case physically, disuse feeds on itself. When we are young and our brains are highly plastic, learning even complex skills such as a language is relatively easy. As we get older and exercise these muscles less, the challenge of learning a new language or a new skill tends to be more difficult and frustrating. To avoid discomfort, and in some cases humiliation, our inclination is to give up. The result is that the avoidable deterioration of our capacity continues. Marjorie Silver, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and associate director of the New England Centenarian Study, says that every time you learn something new, it builds new connections to the brain cells. That way, if you do have a few changes, a few plaques and tangles associated with Alzheimer's, and if a few brain cells become damaged, you still have a reserve because of all those additional connections you have built up. Put another way, continuing to challenge the brain protects us from decline as we age. Just as learning a new sport forces us to build new muscles and to use our bodies in different ways, so learning new computer skills or taking a new course, or even learning a few new words of vocabulary each day, pushes us to develop the mental muscles that serve performance. Sarah D. worked as a hospital administrator and fought what she felt was a losing battle for control over her life. At 35, she was single and lived alone. The fact that she didn't have family responsibilities gave her the freedom to work as many hours as she chose. It also made it hard for her to leave her office at the end of the day. A problem solver by instinct, she was the one to whom everyone seemed to turn in a crisis. The result was that her time never felt like her own. Mail, memos, unfinished projects piled up on her desk. Sarah told us that she admired both efficiency and creativity, and that because she had so little of the former, she seemed to find no time for the latter. Time management, we tell our clients, is not an end in itself. Rather, it serves the higher goal of effective energy management. Because we have a limited number of hours in a day, we must not only make intelligent choices about how to use them, but must also ensure that we have the energy available to invest in our highest priorities. Too often, we devote our time to activities that don't advance our mission, depleting our energy reserves in the process. Stephen Covey captures this deftly in The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People when he describes how often the urgent in our lives, what seems most demanding in the moment, crowds out the important, priorities that are ultimately more consequential, but don't necessarily require immediate attention. The same is true of many corporate cultures, where a constant sense of emergency makes it difficult for anyone to step back and make more thoughtful choices. Urgency was precisely Sarah's issue. Fiercely action-oriented, she was forever reacting to the demands of others. Phone calls, emails, and people arriving at her door with pressing concerns consumed her energy all day long. Creative brainstorming, reflection, and attending to longer-range planning and writing projects all tended to get pushed aside. Partly the issue was her attention span. Like many of our clients, Sarah found it difficult to concentrate on any one subject for long. While she took a certain pride in her multitasking ability, answering email, while she talked on the phone, for example, the result was that she rarely gave all of her attention to anything. Her staff had learned that if an issue couldn't be summarized in a few quick bullet points, Sarah wasn't likely to absorb it. Unfortunately, not every issue lends itself to simple resolution. This is especially true when it comes to people's personal issues rather than specific tasks. Although she was nurturing by nature, Sarah was increasingly perceived as rushed and unavailable. The first ritual that Sarah decided to launch was to spend 20 to 30 minutes when she awoke in the mornings, shifting her attention from her usual external focus to an internal one. She wrote in a journal about issues both at work and in her personal life. Writing helped her to feel that she wasn't simply a work machine, and it also gave her a chance to reflect on her relationships on and off the job. Next, Sarah took 10 to 15 minutes to compose a to-do list for the day ahead and the personal organizer that we convinced her to purchase. Sarah had always resisted the idea of lists, but she acknowledged that the demands in her life had exceeded her capacity to keep track of all of them. Finally, during her 30-minute commute to work, Sarah built a mental preparation ritual, thinking through the day ahead and visualizing how she wanted to handle the specific challenges she faced. It took Sarah more than a month to get these initial rituals in place, in part because she resisted at first being captive to such a fixed routine. What she discovered over time was that the morning rituals actually gave her a greater sense of calmness and focus, which made her feel freer and less under siege. Once her morning rituals became relatively automatic, she committed to changing the way that she managed her priorities when she got to work. Her usual practice was to move immediately into reactive mode, reading the previous night's accumulated email or answering voicemail or responding to someone at her door. Instead, she decided to devote the first 60 minutes to whatever project she had deemed most important. Sarah chose 8 to 9 a.m. for this work, both because it was when she felt freshest and because the demands on her time grew as the day wore on. She told her secretary that she did not want to be interrupted during these 60 minutes, except in the case of an emergency. Sarah had mostly used this early morning time for writing projects, which had previously consumed her weekends. Launching her days by being productive on a project of her own choosing gave her a sense of accomplishment and an energy boost for the rest of the day. Sarah also committed to taking an aerobics class at 7 p.m. three nights a week, which forced her to leave work, served as a source of mental and emotional recovery after demanding days, and created an effective transition between home and work. Finally, Sarah became almost religious about building two breaks into her day as a means of ensuring intermittent recovery. The hospital cafeteria was on another floor, and she made it her business to go there at 10 a.m. and then again at 3 p.m. for at least 5 to 10 minutes. Events didn't always make it possible to take breaks at exactly these times, so Sarah simply took them as close to the designated times as she possibly could. Modest as the breaks were, they provided a way to escape the maelstrom for a few moments, to eat a piece of fruit, or to drink a cup of tea, and to regroup. Failing to respond instantly to people's requests was very difficult for Sarah at first. By the second month, however, the increased freedom, clarity, and productivity she felt far outweighed her guilt. Because she was more focused and productive, she also found that she was more comfortable taking time with people, both about strategic issues at work and about their personal concerns, especially at the end of the workday. To her surprise, the new structure in her life gave her a sense of freedom and relaxed energy.
The quantity of energy we have to spend at any given moment is a reflection of our physical capacity. Our motivation to spend what we have is largely a spiritual issue. Fundamentally, spiritual energy is a unique force for action in all dimensions of our lives. It is the most powerful source of our motivation, perseverance, and direction. We define spiritual not in the religious sense, but rather in more simple and elemental terms. The connection to a deeply held set of values and to a purpose beyond our self-interest. At the practical level, anything that ignites the human spirit serves to drive full engagement and to maximize performance in whatever mission we are on. The key muscle